Accession number 30493, reel 18.
Yes.
What effect on your attitude towards the war did the witnessing the results?
Well, then again, I can only have to keep referring to the diary, you see. In my memory, it's after confusion, you see. I don't know what I know what's in the diary, and there's no doubt my comments over and over again are concern about the suffering of the Italian people. I was always aware of the costs as we moved up. I mean, just occasionally they didn't move out. It's extraordinary the way they would hang on to their farm, their farmhouse, and occasionally we would actually live with them briefly and discover what they'd been through, what suffering and the torment of having the Germans through their land and then us coming up afterwards and occupying the same land. What I thought, well, I was concerned because I had this steady flow of literature from pen friends, and I was reading. My diary often refers to a book I'm reading in between serving the gun and writing the diaries. But really, as I said, there's today there's this confusion in my mind because of these five versions that are all mixed up in the cocktail. I can't get over what I've been going through really the last few weeks. It's the very fact that I'm reading on tape these words, which come into conflict with memory, but of course they back up my reading, the post-war reading, the history, the personal accounts, and but there's no doubt about my growing hostility to my growing awareness that the war was mistaken in Italy, just because when we got bogged down in 1944. I mean, 44 was the year we're going to win in Italy, no doubt about it. Brass hat thought so, Churchill, Eisenhower thought so. They had not allowed for the winter. The fact that armour would just sink into the mud. How amazing, really, all those military brains, you know, the products of military academies. And they hadn't thought about the weather. That's so typical, isn't it, really? Look at the blunders, military blunders that go on and on and on. Yeah, I've got several books on the shelves there about military blunders in World War One and World War Two, and millions of men killed and wounded as a result of it. Blunders. And I've no trust in brass hats or generals. Every now and again there's a general comes along who's actually got some brains, and he writes a book about it, you know. There's a general here who was chief of the army, and he's written a book called the Futility of Force: The Art of War in the Modern World. That's General Sir Rupert Smith, who was a top general. And he says, why do we try to use military force to solve our political problems? Now, the penny's dropped for him, but it hasn't dropped... it hasn't dropped for most military people, you know. And there's a terrific book there, of over 400 pages, And there he is, there's a photo of him, the real tough, there he is in his red beret. It's the epitome of the fighting general. It's a work of exceptional clarity and depth that ought to set the agenda for the next transformation in how armed power is used, when it is to be used, and even why. Written by that rarity, the intellectual warrior is an essential work for the period we are entering. Now, if you know, if only a man like that had been around in World War II, we wouldn't have fought in Italy. He would have seen that the weather wasn't suitable. Accompaniment to the plans that had been made. And so there was this utter failure in 44.
Well, aside from the issues with the winter then...
Sorry?
Aside from the issues with the winter,
yes.
How do you feel the overall Allied strategy and the specific tactics
well,
in Italy
were? Well, don't forget, Churchill said, Italy is the soft underbelly of Europe. Now, how can you call the mountainous terrain? I mean, what was the matter with Winnie at that point? Didn't he look at the map and look at these, well, the great massive mountain ranges and the rivers that crisscross the Italian peninsula? How could he say it was a soft underbelly? It's extraordinary. I mean, he was a military, he had a lot of, well, he was a military historian. Mind you, I mean, it's interesting, Churchill wanted to find out what was happening in Yugoslavia, and his best friend was a chap called Professor Deakin, who was a professional historian. And really, Deakin is behind Churchill's historical works. He provided, you know, the facts and everything that Churchill wanted. Churchill provided his florid style of writing, you know. But he trusted this man, and he decided to drop him into Yugoslavia by parachute. So this British party dropped out of the sky right into the middle of Hitler's most ferocious campaign to destroy. It was the fifth time he tried to destroy the partisans in the mountains. And Deakin dropped in right in the middle of it. And they contacted Tito and his headquarters in the mountains. Just at the time it was being bombed. And the bomb that injured Tito, injured Captain Deakin, and killed one of his men. Famously, Tito's dog leapt onto Tito, brought him down, and they claim that the dog saved his life. But Deakin wrote this wonderful book, The Embattled Mountain. But he had to wait 25 years before he could do it, because that personal experience and involvement meant, I must quote a bit from the book. And he says, as a preface to the book, he says, every exertion to blend the mental images of a witness, well, that's like me, you see, with the detached reconstruction of a scholar, spent itself in a confusion of disordered riches. Now, I think that's lovely. A confusion of disordered riches. Now, that's the fact is the kind of confusion I'm in. And because he was so involved in that campaign, at that level, and under with death all around him, The partisans had 3,000 injured partisans with them, which they refused to leave behind because they know they'd all been butchered to a man by the Nazis. and they carried them through that this terrible, terrible campaign. To read about it is extraordinary. Somehow they did escape with their wounded, save their wounded, through the mountains, and hit the massive onslaught, just failed to destroy Tito and his partisans. And of course, it was that experience that meant that Deakin had to wait 25 years to see he could sort of sit back and try and be objective as well as, you know, an impassioned participant. I had to get that in because that's such a wonderful book. Tells you so much about what it meant that in that terrible war.
What do you remember of VE Day itself?
Which day?
VE Day.
Aha! Yes! Well, you see, the memory is a photograph. I mean, there's quite a detailed account in my diary. So it's there, in the words I wrote down at the time. Now, in my memory, all I have is we were told that, we were given a day's leave to celebrate the victory in Europe Day, and so we all converged on Venice, and it was announced that Churchill would be making a speech, and it would be relayed in the Piazza St. Mark, Piazza San Marco, to Mark's Square in the centre of Venice, which is, I mean, anybody who's been to Venice knows it's the really centre of the city. So there we were, all packed in there, from every kind of, every unit, massive khaki-clad troops. And I remember some of our officers were there. Somehow they found seats to sit on. And we're standing around, and then Church's voice comes over the loudspeakers announcing that the total surrender of all armed German forces, and that today was Victory in Europe Day. Now, I had my camera with me, and I've got this, what I think, quite a historic photo, because if you open the newspapers the next day, anywhere in the Allied world, you'd have seen joyous photos of excited people in the streets, kissing each other, cheering, waving, and generally having a good time because the war's over. Now, my photo, it shows all these guys in khaki with serious faces, you know. Now, what are they looking so bloody glum about, you think, at such a time? How is it I've got that photo? And what makes it as a photograph, I mean, just as a photograph, is against a great mass of khaki is this one sailor, and he stands out in the middle in his sailor's uniform, and, you know, as a photograph, it makes a photograph. But really, historically, you have to say, why is Churchill announcing the end of the war? Why are these soldiers so bloody glum? And of course, the war in the Far East is not over. And every single one of them, including me, is thinking, oh my God, are we now going to be posted off to the Far East to fight the Japanese? It's on their faces. But then you see, you need to know all that to get the full sense of the mean. You know, a photograph has to be read, and to read it, you really need to know when it was taken, who they're listening to, and what they're thinking, to get the full meaning of a photo. I'm very pleased with that. I think it's the most important photo I took, I think. So that's Venice for me, yes. The only other, there again, you see, up into my head popped the photographs. I've got a nice photo of, there were Highlanders in there wearing their kilts. That's a very strange sight to the average Venetian. And I got a nice shot of a couple of Italian girls who were sort of turning their heads and watching these skirted soldiers going by. That's quite nice. There's another photo I've got of an American with his cine camera set up on a tripod, pointing it over the Bay of Venice. So that's it. I've got another photo of divers at work and who were fishing around for a sunken boat. That's my memory of Venice. And one or two conventional photos of bridges and the general beauty of Venice. See, that's it. I can't remember. We haven't got to this point, but I'm convinced I'm only really becoming aware that I suffered a traumatic, I must have had, you know, today everybody knows, talks about trauma after a war, or soldiers are expected to be traumatic, but at that time, it wasn't currently known, or reported, or people weren't even aware that soldiers back from the war might be affected by it, you know, psychologically. But I've discovered, I've suppressed it all these years, I must have had a traumatic experience, because what happened, the war ended in 1945, you know, soon after the Churchill announcement, I was on a waiting list, and had a month's leave in London at home. What happened after that? I had 2 more years to serve in the army. Those 2 years, they're blank. What was I doing? It's a black hole. And I put it down to the fact that when I was sent back to Italy for another year. Now, what had made the war bearable for me was my camera, my diary, the bag of books that I had with me, my pen friends, and swimming. I was such a keen swimmer that wherever I could rip my uniform off and plunge in, I did. You know, a dirty stream, the flowing river, or the beautiful sea, I was in it, you know. And I could swim a mile at a time, no problem. It was a liberation. Now, when I went back to Italy the second time, for another year, I've made a note here, I don't take my camera, I don't start a new diary, I say, surely I must have had some books with me, there's no record of me going swimming, for God's sake. I have no memory. Now, when I say here, why didn't I use this great opportunity to learn Italian properly? I knew a bit of pidgin Italian. And also, why didn't I seize the chance to find an Italian wife while I was out there? And explore the country. Did I go swimming? Why didn't I make some contact with the left-wing Italians? I would have been made welcome by any socialist or communist Italian family at that time. It's extraordinary. There are only three or four incidents I can remember in that year. Firstly, I know I had to report back to, it was turned out, it was the crack Royal Artillery Regiment, the first Royal Horse Artillery, very proud tradition, the first RHA. Now, I was sent out there, of course I didn't know anybody out there, I joined this unit, and they had the 25 pounds, but these were now on a self-propelled a chassis or whatever. But I have no memory of actually memory at all of actually having anything to do with them. God knows what I was doing. The other memory is I was on guard. Now I was put on guard duty, and in the inspection proceeding it, I was the best man. That meant I was one of the most spick and span out in uniform, etc. So all I had to do was get cocoa for the guards during the night and have a good night's kip. Now the third thing, this is only three things I remember of a year in Italy, believe it or not. I went on selling my army issue cigarettes on the black market, I have to admit. So I had a few extra 100 lira in my pocket, and I thought, well, the clothes rationing at home is so severe that let's buy a suit while I'm out here. And I remember going with a mate of mine there to a shop, a tailor's. And I bought a suit there. I can remember putting it on, and this other guy sort of staring at me enviously in a civilian suit, which turned out to be horrible. I don't think I ever wore it actually afterwards. But how strange. Isn't that strange? Those three odd memories. And a great hole in my life. If I've written here, 19 months out of my life, practically no memories. Now that's a thought, isn't it? I haven't, and yet I've only recently sort of faced up to it and asked myself why it happened. And I think it's because I lack those props. No matter how tough it was in the war, I had these props. That was the camera, the diaries, the books, the swimming, undoubtedly. And then the pen friends, the flow of letters and books and articles, clippings from pen friends. So that all disappeared, you see. And of course, that biggest thing of all, a sense of purpose, that we were fighting an enemy that wanted to conquer the world, and that was it, that was the purpose of our lives at that point, to stop that happening, and die if necessary. After the war, we were an army of occupation, we were part of, and got, Allied military government of occupied territories. An empty existence, utterly empty. And I'd made it worse for myself by going there without these props. Now, I'm sure this is why I've got that just traumatic absence of memory. Now, because it continued, because the last few months in the army I spent in Wales with the first training regiment. So I was with all these young conscripts, you know, all in their 20s. And I would be 27 then. And I've very little memory there of those months in Wales. Rhyl, a training camp outside Rhyl. I've got three peculiar memories, that's all. I didn't have a camera. I didn't keep a diary. I certainly went swimming. Happily, there was in the camp, it's quite well equipped, and there was a swimming pool. And I used to use that regularly. And in fact, I was there as a sort of a lookout when the young guys had to cross the pool in full army kit with a rifle, and I think ropes were strung across the pool, and they had to drag themselves through the water, haul themselves through the water with their with boots and uniform, and carrying a rifle and keeping the rifle dry. That's the kind of, you know, training at the time. And the PT instructor was in there supposedly to give confidence to everybody. And he disappeared. The PT instructor was sunk in the middle. And happily, I was there, not in uniform, just in trunks. And I dived in and rescued this PT instructor. And hauled him up and got him to the side. And he was rather grateful, I can tell you. So there's just that one memory. There's another memory where I was maintaining a truck and I was levering something back, and a bit of metal spun down out and smashed my thumb. It's still possible to see a lump there. And I managed to walk to the camp hospital. And when I got there, I just fainted, I remember, and spent an hour or two in bed while it was stitched up. So that's two incidents. The third incident was the colonel in charge of the unit thought it was a bloody good idea to ask the men to Blackpool for a day. I'm not sure how far Blackpool is from Wales, but that's my memory. Distinct memory of us visiting Blackpool with the officer and his wife. And the whole unit was invited into this hotel for lunch. And isn't it strange how weird memory is? It's a vivid memory of this, going into this hotel, and there's this long table, and all the young guys sat each side of this table, and there was the colonel and his wife at the top. The waiters came round ladling out the soup. As soon as the soup appeared in front of me, I picked up my spoon and began to gobble it up, you know, being an old soldier, you know. And I looked up, and all these young guys, young conscripts, all still sort of sitting at attention in front of their hot soup, because the officer and his wife hadn't yet been served. And I can remember getting back and gobbling up my soup, and I'd finished for the time all the others had started. An act of rebellion. Isn't it absurd? I mean, all the things I could have remembered, and I remember that incident vividly. A memory